Behind the shed. Richard Coyne, Behind the shed. The 18th of July, 2026. ChatGPT shows an unnerving familiarity with my particular interests and practices, presumably inferred over a large number of interactions. But I am not the only one. A friend showed me part of the transcript of his recent conversation with ChatGPT about his projects involving music software and digital image manipulation. The AI displayed similar levels of familiarity and intimacy. It would even wish him a good night's sleep when he seemed to be overworking his projects. This apparent AI familiarity shared across thousands, if not millions, of keen users was front of mind as I reread some of my articles from 2014. The first of these, number 213, looking backwards, reminded me of long-standing utopian scenarios promoting synthetic intelligences. Personable conversational AI with its utopian and dystopian entailments is with us now. It is the latest tech that impinges on everyday computer users. The second article, number 214, Social Media, Help You to Believe What You Want to Believe, was about the way social media circulate moods, attitudes, and opinions, and serves to confirm personal beliefs, prejudices, and biases. Conversational AI systems seem trained to support our presuppositions and to challenge them only reluctantly. Some practitioners believe that their current project is so necessary it warrants working, playing, scrolling, and chatting long into the night. The personableness of conversational AI encourages and reinforces a kind of positive self-belief, even when humility and some self-doubt would better suit the moment. These reflections led me to focus on my third article, number 215, Back of Shop, that emphasized the human propensity to partition our lives into the private and the public. There I drew on Irving Goffman's persuasive idea that what goes on behind the scenes, in private, is often in contradiction to what appears in the main play, in public, which in social and political life often conforms to expectations of decorum and protocol. Decorum is an old-fashioned word. Thanks to a plethora of contemporary art and entertainment media outputs, the expectation may also reside with the radical, transgressive, and opportunistic. Some actors might even want to project menace, vindictiveness, and Trumpian mobsterism. Whatever front the actor wishes to present, the activity behind the stage is what keeps the facade intact. In Goffman's terms, the backstage is where the public performance is prepared, contradicted, repaired, or simply allowed to relax. In architectural terms, it is the kitchen behind the dining room, the service duct behind the wall, the storage room behind the gallery, the files behind the counter, the attic above the fan vault. But social media, cameras, online video, and live broadcasts have already revealed the fragility of the relationship between the backstage and performance space. What is presumed hidden can be photographed, leaked, shared, streamed, archived, and searched. The front-back metaphor here is one of a number of cultural oppositions explained well enough through structuralist theories of language that suppose the operations of language and culture resides in the expression of oppositions such as hot and cold, clean and unclean, upper and lower, reason and emotion, the oppressor and the oppressed. See post-structuralism in architecture. The front-back distinction also provides an example of metaphor grounded in bodily experience. After all, the human body has a front that sees, anticipates, and reveals. The back is in retreat, leaving stuff behind in concealment. See previous article points of view. There are variants in this ways of thinking about bodily comportment. I recall Jacques Derrida at a seminar in London in the 1990s, saying that, contrary to the emphasis in phenomenology on expectation and projection, looking forward, the world creeps up from behind and takes us by surprise. From an hermeneutical perspective, we could say that the identification of any oppositional situation is a product of interpretation in a practical context, negotiated within an environment or a world, and through some kind of shared or challenged understanding within and across communities of people. I think of the font stage backstage opposition as a provisional fiction that helps structure our experience, not least our experience of conversational AI. In the article of 2014, I suggested 5 manifestations of the front and backstage metaphor. I am interested in how this typology fares in light of AI. 1. Serviced and servant arrangements. In the original article, I referred to Louis Kahn's distinction between serviced and servant spaces. The dining room is served by the kitchen. The office spaces are served by the lifts, stores, and washrooms. The servant spaces are a kind of backstage setting. The distinction is not always so clear, though they are likely to persist as workable architectural abstractions. Visible service ducts, open archives, retail warehouses, recreational and hospitality spaces, retrofits, and necessity readily subvert the spatial implications of front-back categories. I asked ChatGPT to update this front-back distinction in light of AI. It focused on the back-of-shop metaphor, influenced no doubt by the implications of online retail and subscription services. The back of shop is no longer simply adjacent to the shop. It may be dispersed across platforms, servers, licensing arrangements, and supply chains. This is a general observation about the ubiquity of digital infrastructures. Any spatial designer would take this into account. For example, online, CCTV cameras mean that we no longer depend on sight lines and physical proximity to participate in our garden, whether front or back. 2. Undifferentiated space. In the 2014 article, I suggested that there are spaces without service-served delineation. A garden shed is all backstage. A pavilion in a park is all front stage. That implies a kind of smooth spatial encounter, virtually impossible in a multifunctional context of any scale, like fitting a hotel or a hospital in a marquee. ChatGPT latched onto the smooth aspect of this lack of differentiation. Some AI interfaces present themselves as all front stage. The chatbot speaks directly, fluently, and sociably. There is no visible backstage, no obvious machinery, no sketch, draft, hesitation, or correction. The result is an unusually smooth performance. The user stops asking how the result was made, content to remain oblivious to the processes by which the system and its outcomes were produced. 3. Invisible and unknown backstages. I also referred to hidden backstage areas that few of us are likely to visit and probably don't expect to see, such as the attic space above the fan vaults at King's College Chapel in Cambridge, or the inside of the Chernobyl nuclear power plant, both of which I have visited as it happens. The backstage of AI is often not just hidden, but unknowable in practice. Training data may be inaccessible, model behavior may be difficult to explain, generated outputs may have no stable route back to a determinate source. This is different from the attic above King's College Chapel. There, a privileged tour reveals the concealed structure. With AI, there may be no attic tour that fully explains the performance. The backstage is technical, legal, statistical, and infrastructural. 4. Ambiguated spaces. I mentioned how designers may allow the public and the private to break through each other. The backroom store becomes part of the museum. The library, food prep area or ablution block provides the main entrance to the dwelling. I hadn't thought about the machinery. Back of stage, you have the mechanisms that control the on-stage effects. My chatbot focused on the idea that the human is the front stage performer. The machine is hidden in the back. Now each edits, prompts, corrects, and performs with the other. Authorship becomes a mixed region rather than a clean division. 5. There's nothing there. There are those spaces that suggest there is or ought to be a backstage, but there's nothing. ChatGPT translated this into a concern about fake content. There is no original out the back of which the front of stage presentation is a copy. Some generated media imply a backstage that does not exist. A synthetic photograph may show a room that was never built, a person who was never photographed, a city that was never visited, a voice that was never spoken. The apparent evidence points to no prior event. The backstage is not a hidden chamber, but a probabilistic fabrication. There is no original scene behind the image. I'm reminded that often there is no one watching the feed from the CCTV camera. The operations center is vacant, doesn't exist, or its function is distributed, dissipated, ephemeral, vaporized. I think the front of stage, backstage metaphor is helpful when we think of people's interactions as performances. The metaphor has obvious correlates in spatial design. However, it's less usual in discussions about AI and digital media, which seem to be overwhelmed in the current climate by issues of privacy. It's understandable that my AI counselor embarked on an update introducing matters of digital privacy and transparency, reminding me of the EU's AI Act transparency provisions due August 2026. People have the right to know when they are being presented with artificially generated media content. The chatbot equated access to this aspect of the production process to accessing the back of stage. The deeper change is that AI alters the evidential relation between appearance and production. In analog photography, and even in much digital photography, there was usually some scene, however staged, edited or selectively framed. In generative AI, the image may look like a record of access to a backstage, but there was no stage, no access, and no original event. Interestingly, my AI advisor also equated the backstage to a rehearsal space. AI companions and assistants may themselves become backstage spaces. People confide in them, rehearse identities, draft difficult messages, explore fantasies, ask naive questions, and prepare public performances. That said, this backstage is not private, as if a space separated from the public space. It is mediated by a platform. There it may be logged, analyzed, retained, or used to improve systems, depending on the service and settings. The AI opined that the backstage is no longer simply the place behind the curtain. It may be a server farm behind the interface, a data set behind the generated face, a prompt history behind the polished answer, a moderation layer behind the conversational tone, a platform policy behind the illusion of intimacy, a watermark behind the image, or no prior scene at all. Informed no doubt by prevailing opinions within its training data and other sources, my AI consultant seemed to push me towards declaring that AI presents new challenges, as if the old challenges are overturned or exaggerated and multiplied. I prefer to start with the thought that AI reveals aspects of our experience of the front and the back that were present all along in spatial experience, notably its ambiguity and dependence on shifting circumstances. That ends the latest entry, Behind the Shed. Now follow the three articles from September 2014. Looking backwards, September 13th, 2014. What does the Apple Watch announcement this week have in common with Scottish independence? Both claim to be about time, both promise unlimited potential, and neither seems particularly necessary. In fact, technology and politics converge nicely on the theme of utopia. Like a lot of tech, the publicity videos for the not-yet Apple Watch reinforce the benefits of the device, with images of a whole world at your fingertips, the closed looping shape of the variety of wristbands, and the roundy knob at the side called the crown. There are further round features on the back that record your heartbeat and transmit it to someone else, so they can feel it too. This is the new sensitive, feeling, and highly sociable world where your future is in your hands. I mean, on your wrist. On the subject of tech and utopia, I've long enjoyed Edward Bellamy's book about time, called Looking Backward, 2000 to 1887, written in 1888. The book describes life in the year 2000 as imagined by a well-travelled 19th century American. At the core of such utopian writing is the triumph of reason. Bellamy describes his future world as one in which people enjoy the blessings of a social order, at once so simple and logical that it seems but the triumph of common sense. 93. With common sense comes freedom. As it happens, it also comes with compulsory national service. In fact, most utopias require some kind of rigid social order to which everyone must conform. That's the cost of a utopia if it is to raise the race to a new plane of existence with an illimitable vista of progress. Of most interest in the current climate, there's no need for banks. There is neither selling nor buying nowadays. The distribution of goods is affected in another way. As to the bankers, having no money, we have no use for those gentry. Bellamy's book, An Independence, is really about unrealistic social transformation, but I'm also interested in Bellamy's predictions about technology. Goods are transmitted around from warehouse to home via a ubiquitous network of pneumatic tubes. That would ease Amazon's distribution from Dunfermline. Even sparsely populated rural communities are so connected. I had it in mind that people in Bellamy's utopia travel in flying cars, but I think that's from a contemporary illustration by Albert Rabida. One of the miracles of Bellamy's year 2000 was Slash is the transmission of music from performance rooms positioned around the city. Live performances are channeled into homes via high-fidelity telephone. There's choice, so that all tastes and moods can be suited. This is also where time comes in. Before retiring for the night by a clockwork combination, a person could arrange to be awakened at any hour by the music. That prediction was almost on the button. References: Bellamy, Edward, 1967. Looking Backward, 2000 to 1887. Morris, William, 1970, News from Nowhere. Notes: in Bellamy's steampunk socialism, everything is connected by tubes and wires. Wirelessness wasn't yet on the horizon, nor was miniaturization and personalized tech, though he did anticipate credit cards. The featured image is of a fanciful flying machines in a gallery at the Musée des Arts et Métiers in Paris. Below is a Better Together campaign stand in Edinburgh. I discuss Bellamy and William Morris's utopias in Coyne, Richard, 1999. Techno-romanticism, digital narrative, holism, and the romance of the real. On the theme of the circle, see blog posts, Circles, and How to Get Out of Them. And Vitruvius does steam punk. Romantic utopian narratives often resort to circular geometries, which symbolize completeness and wholeness, rather than subdivision and fragmentation. See article Majority of Scottish Academics Set to Vote No in Referendum, The Poll Shows, on why the majority of STEM, science, technology, engineering, maths, academics, think we are better together. That ends the article, Looking Backwards. Social media help you to believe what you want to believe. September 21st, 2014. The Scottish referendum on independence has helped expose something we knew all along about what it is to have an opinion. Some of us are good at filtering out the evidence we would rather not see and accepting only what supports our beliefs. In an article in The Times yesterday, journalist Hugo Rifkind identified the current mood of the so-called cybernats, that is the internet-savvy nationalist campaigners who apparently overestimated the support for independence amongst their fellow citizens. Via Facebook and Twitter, we select the news we want to hear and ignore what we don't, hardening our certainties under the carapace of certainties borrowed from others. I'm the opposite of a cybernat, but in this past intense few weeks, with so much at stake and rising anxiety, I too censored my information streams. You can do it easily with online sources. Admittedly, with reluctance, I defriended at least one friend on Facebook to arrest the flow of links to news clips that kept reminding me of the inevitability and good sense of separation from the UK. Fortunately, I only discovered the tag hashtag Indyref on Twitter the day of the voting. I would have had to switch to a different hashtag to see the world as I wanted to see it. Lots of people have admitted to being persuaded by arguments for or against independence, but persuasion seems to depend on factors other than arguing around facts. Commentators have said you can divide the voters between those who went with their heads and those who listened to their hearts. That is, those who submitted to logic, usually economic logic, and those who formed their opinions on the basis of how they felt. But just about everything I've been reading this past few years on emotion suggests this dichotomy is false. Logic doesn't provide the best model for opinion formation. Neither does emotion. Flaws in pure logic, as the basis of opinion, have been well aired. What of emotion? Rather than assume the absolute reality of emotional states, I find it helpful now to think of the way we use emotional words as part of our armor for self-validation, a currency for negotiating solidarity within a group, verbal offerings to persuade and cajole others into our camp, weapons to cast others into outer darkness. Emotion words are potent. Where one party thinks to point out risk and uncertainty, the other side sees an attempt to sow fear, or at least either party chooses their emotion words to deliver the effect they want. We use words like risk, fear, certainty, freedom, hope, pride, and loyalty as tools to build and test a view of the world as we think we would like to see it. If we need to know how opinions are formed and circulated, then we could do worse than consider the way language communities operate, on and offline. Notes. Also see blog post, emotional words, and accentuate the negative. Perhaps social media users can regulate their moods by altering their Facebook news feeds after all. See post emotional contagion. The tagline of Rifkind's opinion piece in The Times is, "The online yes fanatics sought out only like-minded opinions and refused to believe they could be heading for defeat." Updating the standard lexicon of emotion words, we would have to include gutted. The first picture above is of the visitor centre, Gareth Hoskins Architects, on the site of the Battle of Culloden, 1746. near Inverness. Bibliography: Lutz, Catherine, 1998. Unnatural Emotions: Everyday Sentiments on a Micronesian Atoll and Their Challenge to Western Theory. McFarland, K.T., 2014. Independence for Scotland? It's My Heart versus My Head. Fox News. Rifkind, Hugo, 2014. Sad Cybernats Are Brought Crashing to Earth. Times. That ends the article. Social media help you to believe what you want to believe. Back of shop. September 27th, 2014. It happens all the time. People accidentally disclosing what should be kept private. I'm thinking of David Cameron saying out loud how relieved the Queen was when he alerted her that Scotland would stay in the UK. Guardian. The relationship between the private and the public keeps us fascinated, especially when there's a breach of some kind. The social anthropologist and former Edinburgh academic Irving Goffman developed an understanding of human behaviour in terms of the back and front regions of a stage. A back region or backstage may be defined as a place, relative to a given performance, where the impression fostered by the performance is knowingly contradicted as a matter of course. 114. What goes on behind the scenes is often in direct contradiction to what appears in the main play, which in public and political life is often dictated by rules of decorum and protocol. The less presentable activity behind the stage keeps the facade intact. Of course, Goffman's construction is a theatrical and an architectural metaphor. Here's the start of a typology of backstage architecture that foregrounds space as well as human behavior. Serviced and servant. Louis Kahn famously delineated architectural spaces in terms of serviced and servant spaces. There's the main showcase area of a museum and the back rooms where material is prepared for display, where administrators do their work, files are stored, etc. In a shop, there's the customer area and the back of shop. These are fairly obviously delineations, and there are breaches between the two, as in the case of backstage and workshop tours. Undifferentiated space. On the other hand, there are those spaces where there is no such delineation. A garden shed is all backstage. A pavilion in a park is all front stage. Invisible and unknown. Then there are those hidden backstage areas that few of us are likely to visit and probably don't expect to see. The famous King's College Chapel in Cambridge has the appearance of a light and airy, simple pavilion with nothing hidden. Ambiguated spaces. Sometimes designers work with the relationship between the public and the private, allowing each to break through the other, to enfold each other dynamically and ambiguously. Curators at the Railway Museum in York have opened up the area where railway paraphernalia is tagged and shelved, but not displayed. The workshop can also be viewed from walkways open to visitors. There's nothing there. There are those spaces that suggest there is, or ought to be, a backstage, but there's nothing. There's no content, contraption, or works to the back of stage to keep the show on the road. There may not even be a space. It's a bit like exiting a circus tent to discover you're just in an open field. As Goffman says, as countless folk tales and initiation rites show, often the real secret behind the mystery is that there really is no mystery. The real problem is to prevent the audience from learning this too. 76. Here's a bit of mystery, cultivated and then revealed via privileged access to the attic space above the arborescent fan vaulting of King's College Chapel. These are not the first images online to reveal the secrets of the fan vaults usually accessed by BBC audio engineers recording the Festival of Nine Lessons and Carols. Click to enlarge. Notes. Thanks to Felipe Hernandez for taking me on the tour. Also see mystery philosopher Fake's Own Death, Enchanted Places, Architectural Unconscious. It's fair to say that photography, digital photography, photo sharing, social media, online video, and even mainstream television have reconfigured the relationships between the front and backstage arenas. It's hard to keep anything entirely private now, though people really do preserve the difference between public and private. There's no confusing the film with the outtakes, the dining area with the kitchen, the great and powerful Oz with the man behind the curtain. Today is Doors Open Day in Edinburgh. Every weekend in September, you can explore places that are normally closed to the public. Reference: Goffman, Irving, 1969, The Presentation of Self in Everyday Life. That ends this newsletter, read by Richard Coyne's cloned voice in 11 Labs. Signing off now. Thank you for your attention.